This is Inform Your Resistance with PRA, Political Research Associates. Tune in twice a month to hear experts, researchers, journalists, academics, and movement strategists explain some of the most significant contemporary threats to democracy from the mainstream and far right. With Inform Your Resistance, we distill what you need to know most. I'm your host, Cokie Mendes, Communications Director here at PRA. In case you missed it last week, we're excited to share the launch of a new podcast series, The Insurgents, Sheriffs. This collaboration between PRA and Quintero Productions uncovers how a national network of far-right sheriffs is mobilizing to create a white Christian republic, one county at a time. You can subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jack Giesking, editor at PRA and stepping in for Cokie Mendes while she's out. As we are even closer to the 2024 elections, the new Apostolic Reformation is finally gaining greater attention in the news cycle. What is NAR? Where and who did it emerge from? Is NAR a right-wing movement? And if so, how do we conceptualize it within what has come to be framed as the Christian right? What are the far-right politics that fuel the NAR? And what flames in the far-right does NAR act as fuel for? We're really excited to have Frederick Clarkson with us today, senior research analyst at PRA, who's been writing about politics and religion for more than four decades. His works appeared in a wide range of publications, from Mother Jones Church and State and Ms. Magazine to the Christian Science Monitor, Salon, and Religion Dispatches. He is the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. He's worked as investigative editor at Planned Parenthood, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the group blog Talk to Action. Fred, I'm so excited to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You recently put out A Reporter's Guide to the New Apostolic Reformation with André Gagné, which we recently republished on PRA. There's a very specific and large terminology associated with NAR that embraces their very specific perspective. I want to begin with just a handful of these terms and build so our understanding of what the New Apostolic Reformation is, namely apostles, biblical worldview, spiritual welfare. Please walk us through how NAR churches walk with this language in mind.
Well, sure. One thing to say just by prefacing that, and that is people who may be familiar with Pentecostals and people who pray with their arms high in the air and they pray in tongues, they have other what they call gifts of the Spirit. And after Roman Catholicism, it's the second largest Christian faction in the world and the only significant growth sector. And it's a little hard to see sometimes in our various communities, but it really is a historic consequence in the history of Christianity and of religion. And the New Apostolic Reformation is really the political organizing and aspect and the thought leader of this movement at this time. One of the things that differentiates NAR from much of Pentecostalism and all of the other rest of Christianity, and that is that they think that Christianity's gotten it wrong for 2,000 years in terms of doctrine, in terms of leadership, and they don't believe in denominations. So when you hear about non-denominational churches, this is usually what we're talking about. So what they think is correct, and that is discussion in the biblical book of Ephesians about apostles, prophets, teachers, evangelists, and pastors, and it encompasses what they call the fivefold ministry. It's not a strict hierarchy in the way we might think of, you know, traditional Christian offices, popes and bishops and things like that, but you have to have all five to get working together to be a church leadership structure. But the thing that's particularly unique and often alarming about NAR and a political consequence for our purposes is that apostles and prophets have direct communication with God and speak with him all the time. So the things that you see in the Bible may not be necessarily so because God has a new word all the time.
Wow. And biblical worldview. Tell us more about that.
Well, that's a term that comes out of a theocratic theology called Christian Reconstructionism and a lot of Reformed Christianity. And that's the idea that the correct way to look at the world and all the things in it is through the what they call the lens of the Bible and only the Bible. And that if other ideas are coming in, regardless of the source, it's potentially, you know, the devil getting in. It's a delusion. And that the only corrective you can put on those things is biblical. So that has social and political and governmental consequences, because you have to figure out, well, what does the Bible say? But if we're going to have a Christian nation, well, for example, what should that look like? And so there's a theologian named R.J. Rushdoony, an American theologian who of the 20th century, who kind of figured that out. He took all the Ten Commandments and all the stories of judicial applications of the Ten Commandments he could find in the Bible and crunched them all together in a book he called The Institutes of Biblical Law. So when they're talking about a biblical worldview as it relates to politics, that's what they're talking about, and government. Now, not everybody agrees with Rushdoony, but everybody has to measure themselves by the Rushdoony standard because he's the only one that's ever done that.
And so how long has NAR been around? Where did it come from? How did we get here?
Well, it depends how you define it. Now, there's this guy, C. Peter Wagner, was a theologian at Fuller Theological Seminary, who died some years ago. But he and some colleagues were seeing changes in what they called the church, usually meaning Pentecostalism, but not only Pentecostal, evangelicalism more broadly. They were becoming increasingly non-denominational and changing the way that their church governance. And they saw different aspects of the changes globally, because they were scholars of these things. And they began to see that the changes of the church reflected something new. And a lot of the ideas of the Reformation, Protestant Reformation, they understand it. Hence, the Rushdoony kind of stuff was filtering in to these church movements. And so that's what was new, and that's what was Reformation. And it was apostolic, because they had this idea of the fivefold ministry. So that's how that came about. In the 90s, Wagner and some of his other associates decided to say, okay, well, there's this big, messy movement out there with all these different pieces. Let's acknowledge that this is something new. Let's recognize it for what it is, and let's see if we can shape it, organize it, and lead it. And so they all recognized each other as apostles and others as prophets. So C. Peter Wagner and his colleagues decided, well, let's recognize these trends. We know that they're varied and at different states of development along the way, and they don't always even agree with one another. But they decided it was time to recognize that and to begin to give some shape and organization and leadership to the explosive movement in Christianity. And so they decided that it's new. And they decided it was apostolic, because they were going to have apostles and prophets and recognize the fivefold ministry. And that's kind of where things were headed in a lot of places anyway. They wanted to encourage that. And it was reformed, you know, Reformation, because they saw it as the most consequential movement since the Protestant Reformation, and there were specific reformed kind of ideas coming out of these R.J. Rushdoony and Reformed Presbyterian kind of circles that gave a systematic theology dimension that a lot of Pentecostalism just did not have. And it took it into the kind of conservative, biblical worldview, kind of Christian right political activities that we see them engaged in now.
So let's turn to the political element of what's happening with NAR. There's the Seven Mountain Mandate, and you recently wrote, quote, "The notion of the Seven Mountains has, according to one 2024 scholarly poll, been spreading rapidly and now dominates evangelical Christianity even beyond the portion of evangelicals in the charismatic Pentecostal camp," end quote. The Seven Mountain Mandate, we keep hearing about it. What is it? And why do NAR adherents wish for this to happen? Why do they want this specific form of Christianity?
Well, it goes to what we were talking about before, and that is the idea that if you're looking at things through a biblical worldview, it's the only correct view. And so a key idea within all this is that Christians of the right sort should have dominion over society and all of its aspects, right? The family, religion, government, media, and arts and entertainment, and education, and business. So they decided, well, there's a lot of complicated theology, and these are folks who are moving away from doctrines and denominations, but they still have to stand for something. And then they felt the need to take dominion, but they also needed something that didn't require a PhD in theology to understand. So the idea of the Seven Mountain Mandate was created because everybody could understand it. It's like, okay, we need to take all of these keys spheres of influence in society if we're actually going to have dominion. But also meant one other really important thing, and that is we usually think of churches and Christianity in terms of denominations, individual parishes and pastors, and you know, occasionally there's a hierarchy of bishops and things like that. But they're thinking, you know, it's the job of every Christian to be involved in this conquest of the mountains. So everybody gets to have a ministry. You don't have to be a pastor or to have a degree in theology to have a ministry. And many people who have ministries do not have any advanced education. But you can be an educator, a teacher, be involved in arts and entertainment, and certainly politics and government. And that's part of your ministry. And that's how you're going to help to achieve societal dominion and fulfillment of God's intentions.
And so by leading in all of these factions, there will be a global rule then by NAR adherents and people who believe in the New Apostolic Reformation and are part of it.
Yes, but not necessarily a big governmental institution. They're much more anarchic than that, at least in the way that they describe it. And they're not even quite sure what all these things are going to look like. You could say they're making it up as they're going along, or, you know, they're learning their lessons, or maybe God has some further intentions he has yet to reveal. They don't know and they don't care. They're headed in the direction where the apostles and the prophets and God himself are telling them to go, and they'll find out what it's like when they get there.
For decades, we've used the term Christian right in this very kind of generalized way for our understanding of right-wing Christian movements. But the New Apostolic Reformation movement has been gaining greater power and reach. How do we conceive of the Christian right with NAR in mind?
A lot of the folks who comprise what we now think of as the New Apostolic Reformation as leaders have actually been around quite a while and been a central part of the Christian right. It's just that their movement and the thought behind it has evolved, but it has roots in the people be most familiar with Pat Robertson and the people around the Pat Robertson campaign for president. That's where we first saw the big manifestation of what we would now call the New Apostolic Reformation in politics, and that's only grown over time.
Are there other factions, when you think of the Christian right as someone who's been covering it for decades, that you see as equivalent to NAR, or how do you identify it in relation to other groups?
Well, of course, there are lots of different kinds of factions, and there's all kinds of conservative Catholics, and there's certainly all kinds of fundamentalist Protestants, and these folks are not fundamentalists. They believe in continuing revelation. Fundamentalists are secessionists. Things stopped at a certain point. So there's certainly, you know, Southern Baptists that are denominational and very conservative have been, or, you know, Jerry Falwell's generation of significance in the Christian right. But there are fewer Southern Baptists than there used to be, fewer Southern Baptists in general. But the growth is in the Pentecostal sector, hence the significance of the politics of NAR. So you look at some of the famous photographs of Donald Trump with Christian leaders standing around him and laying hands on him and praying for him, and there are a lot of them. You get a variety of Christian right leaders and important, you know, Southern Baptists, but a lot of the key people are known apostles in the New Apostolic Reformation. And you'll always see one woman up front with the very blonde hair, and that's the apostle Paula White Cain, who has been Donald Trump's spiritual advisor.
When we think more about these politics, and we're definitely going to get back to these key leaders and actors in NAR and people who are large believers with significant positions in the government and otherwise, what is the New Apostolic Reformation's take on things like immigration, racial and ethnic minorities, abortion, and so on, compared to the Christian right? And how do they work against these things or with these things? How does that work?
Well, even with the Christian right, old school Christian right, it was always a little more complicated than the way that they were described or they even thought of themselves. So first, let's set aside that there's never been a group of people who thought entirely alike. But NAR brings new wrinkles to this. You know, on immigration, for example, key leaders will say that they're opposed to illegal immigration, but they also know that many of the people who are in the country here illegally are Pentecostals themselves, coming from Latin America and Africa, and they support them, and they're recruiting them into them. So they're tolerant and supportive, and they see them as a wave of the future. You know, they understand that it's complicated, but just because it's complicated doesn't mean they're not supporting their fellow Christian. And he's not the only one who feels that way. So I think they would be, they're an underappreciated ally in some of the nastier aspects of anti-immigration politics, because they don't agree with the way that immigrants are being treated. They value them as fellow Christians and human beings. On abortion, they're 100%ers. They're centrally a part of the anti-abortion movement. The Dobbs legislation in Mississippi, you know, that was from became the base of the Dobbs case, was, you know, the idea came from an NAR anti-abortion figure. On all aspects of gender, you know, it's they're again it. But also use severe rhetoric and potential violence, particularly against trans people. And they're among the people who are scapegoating trans people for all of society's problems for religious and political advantage this year. And they're cynical about it, I think, too. So, their motives are not always as pure as they would like to suggest and can use ruthless means to achieve power.
And I would assume also deeply anti-LGBTQ as well in general.
Yes, totally. Let's put it more simply. Anything that falls outside of traditional male-female gender roles and traditional marriage is one of those, is demonic.
You did say something that stood out to me, which is that Trump's spiritual advisor is a woman. And so there are women leading in this organization. How do race and gender play out in being an apostle and being part of NAR?
The simple way that I look at it is that NAR is multiracial, multi-ethnic, multinational, and they do have women in leadership. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is necessarily equal. They are all products of our various societies, but there's just no question about it. There are African-American apostles and prophets and important women who are involved in these things. And they can be Christian nationalists and take the sort of view of God intended America to be a Christian nation, all that stuff too, but they're not exclusivists, because all nations should be Christian. God intends for all nations to be Christian. And what's more, is they're a lot less concerned about national boundaries and sovereignty and stuff like that, because they're living in the end times. And God doesn't care about those things. God cares about creating, helping to empower the universal church to fully embody his will. So they may wave the flag, but they're not flag wavers.
I want to turn now to a series of incredibly timely NAR in the News items that relate to elections and governance. First is Project 19. We hear so much about Project 2025, but the American First Policy Institute, a 2021 founded think tank to promote former President Trump's public policy agenda, has been working with, in your words, several dozen movement partners, including Turning Point USA, Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition, and the Family Research Council. They're also deeply connected to Apostle Lance Wallnau, who recently made headlines for calling Kamala Harris Jezebel, who have teamed up to work on Project 19, a project just as impactful as Project 2025, but we hear much less about. Can you tell us about Project 19? And also, can we go back to Project 2025 and how NAR fits into both of these things, if at all?
Well, it's that's complicated. It's probably a bit more than we know or will easily find out. Some of the groups we just named are a part of the group that put together Project 2025. It wasn't just the Heritage Foundation, about 100 groups. And they overlap somewhat with four dozen groups that are involved with the America First Policy Institute and working on Project 19. And before we talk about Project 19 specifically, we should say that, as you said in your question, that is, the America First Policy Institute was actually founded, with Donald Trump, and intended to be the entity that carried out the ongoing policy advocacy and formation after his presidency. The Heritage Foundation has a long history, and the 2025 thing didn't happen till later. But they're on a parallel track in terms of thinking about policy and also recruiting talent for the next Trump administration, so that they'll be able to fill offices quickly. Both 2025 and the America First Policy Institute say that they're doing the same things. How much of what the America First Policy Institute is actually doing in that regard is a little bit hard to say, because they're not as public about it as Project 2025. And they put together the new version of Mandate for Leadership that the Heritage Foundation has always done. So it's a little bit hard to tell how much of a there is there. But the people who they have assigned to the various committees are substantial people who came out of the Trump administration. So it's a little hard to tell. Now, my feeling about it is that they're doing serious work. They're just doing it a lot more quietly. And they're not making what I think of as a strategic mistake in publishing what they're going to do. I mean, I think it is one of the biggest mistakes that the conservative movement has ever made, is to publish that thing and let everybody know, because now it's become an opposition rallying point. Even Kamala Harris is talking about it. this kind of thing has never happened in the history of the Democratic Party, to know what the agenda is, talk about it, and denounce it in this way. Completely different.
A great mistake for the Democratic Party, then.
To their advantage. Now, if Trump loses, these are policies they're still going to be pushing with the Harris administration, and they're policies that will find their own versions at the state level, too. Meanwhile, the America First Policy Institute, they have a little summary book here. So they have like 10 pillars of a policy that they want to found the new administration on. And this version, the little book that I'm holding here, they've taken sort of the streamlined secular version of the 10 pillars, and now they're calling it biblical foundations, and everything's justified as biblical verses. And the whole project is headed by none other than Apostle Paula White Cain. And there are lots of NAR people involved with this at different levels. So you're not going to find named NAR people involved in 2025. They're all over the America First Policy Institute. That brings us along scenic route to Project 19. Because the America First Policy Institute has been collaborating with Lance Wallenau and other parts of the New Apostolic Reformation, with as well as the other partners that they have, on something very specific. And it's not governmental, it's political. And that is, in their assessment, there were, in the key swing states that Donald Trump lost, there were key counties where the difference could be made up this time. And what they're looking at were blue suburban counties in metropolitan areas in these swing states where the percentage of the evangelical vote was a lot less than elsewhere in their own state. So they thought they could make up that difference just by turning out the evangelical vote that they think they already could get in those swing states to maybe make up the difference and turn the election to the result that they desire, which was a smart strategy. And they've been working on it for a couple of years now in 9 states and 19 counties. But here's the key element to how NAR is doing it. And that is that for the past couple of years, they've been identifying conservative Christian voters who are not registered, or they're registered and they're not voting, or they're infrequent voters. And they've developed means to reach out to them and try to bring them in and turn them out in the numbers that they're shooting for. And once they find somebody, say, okay, you got me. I'll vote, I'll be a part of this thing, you're right. So they get them registered or make sure they're registered in the right place. And they've got their name. And then they prepare to turn them out for early voting. Most states have some form of early voting, particularly since COVID, where you don't want to have to stand in long lines, be exposed to in big rooms and have the risk of exposure. So early voting has expanded enormously. And so they want to do what's called in politics banking votes. The earlier you get your people to the polls, you don't have to worry about them anymore. You can go find other people and turn them out. This is what organizers do. And they're doing it very well. There's also something, or it's available in every state, but there's also called ballot harvesting or just ballot collection. And that is where you can take somebody else's completed absentee or mail-in ballot and either mail it or turn it in for them. If you do it for a whole bunch of people, like that, we know this was going on in churches in the last election, and that is you get a bunch of people to bring in their absentee ballots to church and some designated person collects them all and turns them all in as a group. That's ballot harvesting. And it's something that a lot of the stop the steal kinds of people, a technique that they're opposed to, but some of their closest allies are the very people who were doing it. There is concern about that it could be abused, but I haven't seen any evidence that that's ever actually happened, but it's theoretically possible. So it's still controversial. In some states, you can't do it at all.
And so this is happening in the churches, but also these churches, leaders from these churches are on tour. So right before the election in October 2024, Apostles Lance Wallenau, Sean Foyt, Lou Engel, they'll all be leading, respectively, the Courage Tour, Kingdom to the Capitol Tour, and the Million Woman March. What are the goals of these marches and tours? Can you walk us through them?
Well, yeah, the Courage Tour links most closely to what we've just been talking about. Lance Wallenau was one of the architects of Project 19. But they also recognize that, if you're a conservative evangelical in these blue suburban counties, you may not be entirely comfortable expressing yourself or being wholly who you are as a conservative Christian among people who don't agree with you. And so Lance Wallenau wants to give them the courage of their convictions and to be out there and be who they are, hence the Courage Tour. And that's the main message. So it's also giving them the tools of electoral empowerment, shall we say, to go out there, be bold, get your neighbors, go out there and, you know, win this one. So that's what that's all about. Lance Wallenau is going to be in the Pittsburgh area on September 27th and 28th. I think it'll be the last event on the Courage Tour, but it's not the only event that he does. He's taking these same kinds of training into a lot of other places. We don't always hear about them all, but we know that it's going on because this is the key element of the strategy. So that's really important to get. Now, Sean Foyt, he is a musician. He has big, long hair. You know, he's the rad guy who appeals to young people, and he says strong and outrageous things. And he rallies people very effectively. He's been working very closely with Charlie Kirk's Turning Point America and holding rallies all over the place. He's been going to the capital cities of states for the past 2 years to hold these rallies, because part of what he's doing is not just, you know, rallying people in a political way. He's also confronting demonic structures, in his view. And the idea is to take territory, is the phrase that they often use, and to try to take the most darkly held satanic strongholds and confront them. He thinks the capital cities in America are ugly, demonic-infested places, and he's there to shine a light. Lou Engel, been a very important person in recent American history. Almost every presidential election, there's a huge evangelical rally on the Mall in Washington. Hundreds of thousands of people, and it's usually Lou Engel who's involved in organizing it. He was very involved in Washington for Jesus back in the day, more recently events called The Call. But he's moved on a little bit, but he's so good at organizing these things that I'm sure he was encouraged to organize this big event on October 12th called A Million Woman March. I don't think they'll get a million, but they will get a big crowd. And my interpretation of what they're really trying to do is they're trying to answer the gender gap, but they're also trying to define what it means to be a conservative Christian woman, as opposed to, say, a secular feminist or a Christian feminist of some other stripe. So it's a powerful social set of ideas that they're advancing there. They don't want to sacrifice the idea. They want to be pro-woman, and they're going to define it their way, and this should be a defining event.
Can we go back to demons? Because what is a demon? And for those not raised in a Pentecostal or charismatic tradition or acquainted with it in their lifetime, they're very always shocked to hear about demons. So what or who are demons?
You know, if you watch TV or movies, you're seeing demons all the time. And it's not far from what these folks are talking about. These are satanic agents. These are spirits from the pit of hell who are there to carry out evil. So we see specific named ones in the Bible. Pamela Harris is recently called Jezebel, who was a figure, you know, from the Bible, who was a powerful woman who killed some Jews, and but is one of the role models for modern NAR people. They like to take biblical warriors who are carrying out God's will, who did violent things. Rahab is the other main woman, Esther, you know, and among the men, it's, you know, Joshua and David. But in any case, biblical warriors, as they define it, in this case, Jezebel is seen as an ongoing spirit of evil. It's also been used in a racially charged way in American history, calling African-American, charging them as being demonic, slutty, and a threat to the spiritual well-being of men. So charging Kamala Harris in that way, in the way that African-American women have also been charged, has an ugly history. But it shows the religious and the political power of the idea of naming somebody as a demon or influenced by demons. There are a number of named demons in that way, and demons can occupy individuals, you know, in the way that you see in movies like The Exorcist, and there are exorcisms performed all the time. But everybody who is not a Christian of the right sort, all the rest of us who don't believe religiously and politically about them, or maybe of a different gender or different political party, we are either demons or demonically influenced. And, you know, should they get sufficient power fast enough, things would not go well for us. And they understand that in these biblically prophesized end times, and this is a key part of the theology of many in this movement, not all, but many see themselves in what we would think of as an accelerationist mode. And things are going to happen fast. The people of God, as they understand it, will be joined forces with angels sent from heaven in order to wage the end times war and to address the rest of us in order to begin to institute the kingdom of God. They have to clear away all the obstacles. So that's the apocalyptic accelerationist vision. And we hear that from some of them a lot. But it's also incremental, too. And it gets to the paradox of like, well, all this stuff's going to happen. And you know, God's going to come in and sweep us all away anyway. Why do we involve, why are we worried about the school board? Why should we organize our lives to learn all this political stuff and all the things that you do in politics? It seems kind of mundane and pointless, except that nobody really knows when all this is going to happen. And you have to do your best to organize society in a kingdom kind of way, occupy and take territories, as they put it, and occupy them and try to figure out what the biblical governance should be like. So it can be very, very incremental in reality, regardless of whether any of the more apocalyptic visions come true. But those visions can really empower your politics, and I think we're seeing a lot of that.
Speaking of politics and biblical governance, I wanted to talk about how NAR adherents are part of the highest levels of government. Three of the most prominent instances that I'd love to hear more from you about are, of course, House Speaker Mike Johnson, who flies the NAR Appeal to Heaven flag outside of his Washington office. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito also flew the movement's flag outside his summer home. Alabama Chief Justice Tom Parker, who issued citing the Bible in his opinion to determine all frozen embryos are people. But what I find striking about these three cases are often that they're often reported as a sort of singular instance with connections to NAR. But when we look across them as a whole, how do we understand NAR's reach in government?
Well, in the case of Tom Parker, he did an interview on the show by this apostle Johnny Enlow, who with Lance Wallno was the original promoter of the idea of a Seven Mountain Mandate. And they were talking about how they agree about that. Tom Parker's talking about how, you know, that's what is needed to be implemented in society. And there's recordings that Media Matters published about that. And in case of Speaker Johnson, you know, it's more complicated in an interesting way. You know, he goes to a traditional Southern Baptist church, but he's been hanging out with apostles like Jim Garlow for a long time. Jim Garlow is a very politically minded apostle and has been for a long time. And so if you're a politician, Johnson was elected to the legislature before he went to Congress. And just because you are a conservative Christian that may not be the same as other conservative Christians, you're all swimming in the same pond. If you're in politics, everybody knows each other. And you figure out, you know, your religious and differences, and you make it work politically. And I think that's what we're seeing in Johnson's case. But what's so significant is not that I think that he's necessarily an NAR believer, but that the movement is so important that he puts the Appeal to Heaven flag, the NAR battle flag, in front of his office. And the significance of that is he's never really explained. He can explain it away as a flag from history. That's true. It was a battle flag in the American Revolution. But the NAR thinks they're themselves, and as do the January 6th crowd in general, they think that they're in a contemporary American Revolution. So when we talk about the insurrection, that's what we're talking about. When we talk about the reports and the pictures of January 6th, and we see the Appeal to Heaven flag, it's not because some sort of generalized Christian nationalists are running around. It's because it was them. There were apostles who were leading speakers on January 5th and on January 6th. Cheon was there. Cindy Jacobs was there. Dutch Sheets, a big apostle, was having secret meetings in the White House, planning these things in the week before. They were a central part of the story. And as you say, that there are elements you can point to, but they're treated in a singular way. Sam Alito, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, is another good example of how interesting and complicated it can be. It's they're signaling a solidarity with, an affinity with this movement. They're conservative Catholics who aren't going to Protestant Pentecostal churches, but that flag has become a symbol of, or one of the symbols of a larger insurrectionist movement against constitutional government as we currently understand it.
As this comes to mind, I realize one question I think is really important. How do NAR believers see religious plurality? How do they relate to Jews, Muslims, people of other faiths? Do they? And what do they see coming for everyone else in the end times?
They're among the obstacles to advancing the kingdom of God. And, not just minority religions or atheists, but mainstream Christians and Catholics too. Maybe even all Catholics. Because they're just not Christians of the right sort. They're not the body of Christ as they understand it. They're not filled with the Spirit. God is not speaking to their leaders, to those leaders. They're speaking to their leaders. And God will speak his intentions for them. It's really important that the kinds of distinctions and civil rights perspective and pluralist perspective that we bring to religions that don't matter to them. They're all problems of the same sort. And they're all obstacles. Either you're on the bus or you're off the bus, to put it in a different way. Now, in the matter of Jews, it's interesting and important to get into the complications there because, like we were saying earlier, the idea of America as a Christian nation, all nations are Christian nations, but why would that be? Who cares whether they're all Christian nations? Is it only about policy and government and all that stuff? No, it's about the role of Israel in the end times. And the United States is not the principal country, in the end times. You don't see anything about the United States in the Bible, but you do see Israel. And so the idea of a biblically prophesied Israel playing a role in God's intentions of the land in the end times is critical. Politically speaking, the NAR folks are the leading force in what we call Christian Zionism. And as Christians who support the nation of Israel in various ways. And there's also the matter of Messianic Jews. And Messianic Jews are not recognized as Jews by the broad Jewish community, as wide and diverse as it is. Because they're really evangelical Christians, but they understand themselves as what they call to be a completed Jew. And that is somebody who's recognized Jesus as the Messiah. So you see Messianic Jews all over the place in NAR circles. And you'll see in their churches, not just a Christian flag and an American flag, as you see in a lot of churches, but you'll see but the flag of the nation of Israel as well. And that's a very, very common and a tell. It's not exclusive to NAR churches by any means, but it's one of the things you're very likely to see.
You mentioned Dominion before, and recently you updated our Dominionism 101 at PRA. Can you tell people what Dominionism is and how that fits into this?
Well, the idea comes directly from the Bible, and that in the book of Genesis, God directs man to have dominion over the earth and the plants and the animals. And so if you tease out political meaning from the idea of dominion as they have, well, what does it mean to have dominion on the earth? So in their view, it means something like the Seven Mountain Mandate, but a more complicated version is that the Christian Reconstructionists have this, when they're talking about what Christians are supposed to do. They're not saying, well, we're not going to impose a theocracy or, we're going to do this and that. They're talking about dominion, and that is the necessity of Christians to take dominion in the world. And so when we spoke earlier about how this part of Christianity has fused with and influenced Pentecostalism and the charismatic world, you see where the Pentecostals and charismatics have adopted the idea of dominion as well. See, Peter Wagner has a whole book called Dominion. And that's because he has grafted these ideas together to create this NAR movement and to define its one of its principal characteristics as people who are seeking dominion.
Thank you for all of your work and what you shared today. We always conclude on a note for action. So building on your 40 years of work on the Christian right and decade of work on NAR, where do you identify the most strategic interventions in countering the logics, plans, and existing impacts of the New Apostolic Reformation?
Well, those of us who studied these things and tried to expose it and tried to understand it and tell people about it discover that, well, people have a hard time getting their minds around what we're talking about. It's unusual. It's hard to believe that these things are going on in our country and in the world and even in our neighborhoods and that our politicians are influenced by it. What does this appeal to heaven flag mean anyway? So, what we did was we decided to put our best minds together and held a series of webinars to try to explain these things to thoughtful people in thoughtful ways. What I've tried to talk about in those settings and others, and that is the first thing that we need to do, our leadership communities, the religious community, the journalism community, the scholarly community, the political community, we have to choose to know enough about the subject. Can't just wait for some expert to say, oh, it's this, this, and this. There are no talking points. There's no one-pagers. That's just nonsense. This is one of the biggest, most consequential movements in the history of Christianity and in the world. And we're pretending, it's too weird for me. I don't really get it. Well, it's time to get it. But assuming that you make that commitment, say, okay, maybe they're right. I'm going to have to drag myself and read some stuff. Then you, in order to be able to make use of what knowledge you gain, you have to have some vocabulary. If we don't have some common vocabulary that we understand in common, and we're not just nitpick at each other, we can't even have a conversation about what we know and then what to do. So there's that level of commitment too, which is a big chunk out of people's lives and their identity about the way that they view the world.
Thank you, Fred. This has been a terrific conversation. We really appreciate it.
Very glad to do it.
Thank you for listening to Inform Your Resistance with Political Research Associates. The podcast is produced and fact-checked by Olivia Lawrence Weilman and Jack Gieske-King. Hudini Rajagopalan created our communications and marketing materials, and Frank Lawrence, our music. Sound design and mixing by Alicia Crawford. If you haven't already, rate, review, and subscribe. And the best thing you can do to help us is to tell your comrades about the pod. Resisting authoritarianism is better with friends. Until next time.